Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Motorsport Podcast. I'm Ed Foster, and I'm joined by features editor Simon Aaron, audio guru Alan Hyde, and Gilles de Ferran. Very warm welcome.
Good morning, I guess, yeah?
Yes.
Good morning. Yeah. Thank you for having me.
Not at all, not at all. It's an absolute pleasure. So we're going to sort of meander through your career. We've got readers' questions. For those that don't know, there won't be many of them, but 1992 British Formula 3 champion, twice kart champion, Indy 500 winner, a winner in sports cars. And I'm going to nick a fact from Simon Aaron here. I think probably one of the only racing drivers who won their last race, retired, came back, won their last race, and retired. It's unlike Simon to come up with a lesser-known fact.
A lot of guys, I mean, Jackie Stewart was one of your mentors. He retired right to the top. Yeah. I mean, you did it twice.
Yeah, well, it's funny, you know, when I retired the first time, I called Jackie, you know. So Jackie, just wanted to let you know that, you know, that's it. I'm going to stop. He's like, a second of silence. He goes, "How old are you?" I said, "I'm 35. He goes, "Yeah, you lasted one more year than I did."
So. Now, to sort of kick things off, I wanted to rewind right back to your early days.
Yeah.
And they were, obviously, you went karting and you worked on your kart kind of in the evening, something like that.
Yeah.
Where did the love of motorsport come from?
I came from a... call it a family of liberal professionals, you know. So, you know, my grandfather was a doctor, you know, my uncle was a doctor. I had another uncle who was a geologist. The other one was a economist. And but my dad was an engineer. You know, I had another uncle who was an engineer. Actually, they both worked for a Ford Motor Company. And I think everyone... Even my grandfather, I remember, you know, going around São Paulo on the back of his motorbike when I was, you know, whatever, 6, 7 years old, at a million miles an hour, you know. So I guess everybody loved cars and bikes and engines and vehicles and so on. So at home, we didn't really talk about football or politics. So the culture was all about cars, racing, engines, mechanical things, and so on and so forth. And that's the culture I grew up in. And I guess from a young age, as early as I can remember, I was either playing with cars or pretending that I was driving or pretending that I was building a car or building a car, doing that kind of thing.
Because I guess, I mean, when you were 6 or 7 years old as well, Emerson Fittipaldi was just starting to make a name for himself. I mean, was that an inspiration as well?
Or? Yeah, well, look, I guess this is, you know, my memory's a bit so-so.
Like most racing drivers,
a bit so-so, so it's hard for me to remember exactly how I felt when I was that age, you know. But I do remember, you know, the family sort of gathering around and watching Formula One races, you know. As I became a little bit older, obviously became a little bit more aware of Emerson, you know, and what he was doing in Formula One. And certainly when I got to whatever, 11, you know, 9, 10, 11 years old, you know, that my ability to read and retain information increased, you know, you start to sort of consume a lot more information, you know. And that was the late 70s. That one uncle that I had was he was always into racing, you know, in Brazil. And I remember going to a few races and stuff. So, you know, I slowly sort of got introduced and inserted into the sport, and I wanted to race. I think it was whatever nine. Yeah, I think it was like 11 years old, but I don't know. Maybe I don't think we had the means. You know, I don't remember exactly. You know, my father's career was still in the beginning. You know, we were a young family, but yeah, I remember late 70s, early 80s being glued to the TV.
I got told off last time for not asking enough readers' questions, yeah. So I'm just going to go straight
go
in
ahead.
And actually ask some. It's a fool who gets told off twice. So this one's from Wayne Pearson, and obviously we're talking about your early career, and he wants to know just how tough were the 1988 and 89 UK Formula Ford 1600 championships. And who was your biggest rival?
Well, you're jumping forward quite a few years.
Yeah, no, well, I've got pages and pages here of questions. So.
Yeah, well, it was very, very tough, you know, particularly 88. It was very difficult. Not just difficult on the track, you know, it was just difficult in every way that you can imagine, including psychologically difficult, you know. I mean, this, you know, late 80s, you know, I was in my late teens. You know, I won the Brazilian Formula Four Championship in 87. You know, we middle class family, you know, I had a car, a whole bunch of friends, you know, I was going to university at the same time, girlfriend, you know. My life was good, you know, even though I probably didn't realize it at the time. But you know, I had a good life, you know, and after I won the Brazilian championship, I'm like, you know, I'm gonna try a career in sports, because quite frankly, up until then, like I said, because I guess of my family background and so on, a career in sports wasn't really, you know, call it the done thing. You know, it's like, okay, you get your education and you get a job and, you know, and work your way up. And so I was actually torn, you know, whether do I finish my education, do I take a chance at trying to become a racing driver and hopefully reach Formula One, you know, what do I do? Anyway, yeah, at the time in Brazil, I don't know if you can still do that. I don't know if you can do that in England, but you could call it interrupt your studies. You know, I guess you can call it here, take a gap year. So I was in the third year of my university studies. I interrupted my studies. I had two more years to go. And I raised enough sponsorship from the people that were supporting me in Brazil. And I took off over here. So I landed over here. You know, I rented a room in a family home. You know, I guess a bed and breakfast in Silverstone Village. You know, I had no car. I didn't know anyone. and you know, in a foreign country, my language skills are you know, a lot worse than they are today. And so it was difficult, you know. I came in, you know, thinking I was the bee's knees, you know, and the car was, you know, I was used to driving slick tires. Now I'm driving them back to treaded tires. You know, in Brazil, I was in a team. They had a completely different feel, you know. The guy that owned the team, in fact, to this day, he's a great friend of mine, and he was a great mentor to me. You know, he really helped me develop as a person, as a driver, and so on. And I arrived here, it's like, okay, here's the car, you know, go and do your thing. There's your engine, you know. And the first year was a disaster. Really, that's the best way to put it. You know, I was seriously depressed, to be quite honest. You know, the car was not competitive. I was, you know, in this very negative mood, you know, crashing all the time, going way over and above my head and doing crazy things in the car, which is, I guess, is a Formula Ford 1600 thing to do.
They're all crazy, I think.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, the second half of the year, we got a different engine and started doing a little bit better, you know. But, you know, the year was kind of long gone by then, you know. So that was a very difficult first year in England, you know. And quite frankly, if it wasn't for the last race of the year, that was probably the last you would have heard of me. You know, I had the opportunity to do the Formula Ford Festival in '88, but quite frankly, I didn't see the point. I'm like, I've been trashed all year. Why do I want to get trashed again? You know. And one of my sponsors actually was a German company, Sachs, believe it or not. And it's a German gentleman who came. He was working in Sachs in Brazil. Gave me, I think it was, you know, whatever, £1,500 or something like that, and I was able to use that sponsorship to enter the last round of the British Formula 3 Championship in 1988 in a Class B car, you know. And 88 was I mean, there were like 40 cars or something like that. And that race, I felt immediately at home. You know, the car was competitive. I remember I did a test in Snetterton prior to the race, and I was kind of on the pace. And I'm like, yeah, I can do this, you know. And then we went to the Fota test in Silverstone, and it was wet, you know. And they kept me, at the time, there's no radio, right? So they give you boards. So the board was like P1, P2, P3, P2. And I came in, I'm like, oh, it's going okay. So that's in Class B. And I was like, overall, you know. Okay. You know. And then we went to the weekend, and, you know, I qualified on pole position for the Class B race. And that was, I think, 11th overall. I beat David Brabham to the pole. And which would have won literally, I think, every single race in Class B that year. And we clashed on the first lap in Stowe. I spun, you know, did it like a 360, somehow didn't hit anything or didn't get hit, fell to last, and then came back and finished second behind David. And so that race really kind of changed my year, you know. Because of that race, I ended up meeting Rick Horn and Adrian Reynard, you know, who then became very instrumental in the rest of my career. And that propelled me into '89, which I wanted to do Formula 3, but didn't quite have the funding to do Formula 3. And ended up, you know, driving for the Reynard kind of factory team, and '89 was a much better year. You know, we had a competitive engine, competitive car, good team, and I won quite a lot of races. You know, this, you're talking about rivals at that time. Jesus, there's some really good drivers between '88 and '89, Suspiri, Higgins, you know. In '89, you know, Nico was the worked Van Diemen driver. Dave Coyne.
To be fair, Dave Coyne had been there since about 1979.
But you know, actually, it's interesting, right? I think it's Formula 3 now that you can only do so many years.
Now the FIA championship.
Yeah, you're not allowed to do so many. Yeah. And I actually appreciated racing against a guy like him, you know, because he was so good at what he did, you know. And a mixture, to your point, of incredible talented. He was very talented, and experience and cunningness, and you know all of that. That to beat him, you know, it was a very, very difficult task. and it was good for my development, you know. Very good to race against people like that.
Well, Wayne, I think that is the most comprehensive answer we have ever had on a motorsport podcast.
You said we have plenty of time.
If I get more complaints about readers' questions, then I don't know what to do. I read something that about that time you also met Ayrton Senna for the first time, and he was sort of, I think in your own words, he was a god to you.
Ayrton, I actually met Ayrton before. I met Ayrton when I was still back in Brazil in 86, I think, or 85. He was first, second year of Formula One, and I was karting, you know. His reputation in the karting world was incredible, you know. He was already a god, you know, even when he was just karting, you know, even before his career went on to what he did. And I met him when I started doing well in cars and everything. I started training, and I was being trained by the same trainer as Ayrton, who was a fantastic man actually. And he, you know, through him and actually through my father, because Ayrton was being helped by Ford also at the time. So I met him, you know, and just had a couple of conversations with him. He helped actually also helped on the introduction with Ralph Furman to get me to come here. So at least I was not completely unknown to Ralph. Also Mauricio Sandro Sala, yeah. You probably remember, he was a friend of my uncle, so that uncle that I had was raced with Mauricio in Brazil. He also helped with the introduction, and that's the first time really I met Ayrton, who was actually, he told me one thing that I'll never forget, you know. He said, you need to get yourself in a position that the responsibility is on you, you know. I'm like, good. And, you know, and over the years, that always kind of stayed with me.
It's it was about this time that you got introduced to Jackie Stewart and the Staircase of Talent. And am I right in thinking that, I mean, they were obviously a hugely influential force in your career, the Stewarts, and I think you're still obviously still friends with them to this day. That was obviously a big, you look at big turning points in your career.
Yeah, no, I mean, my career was actually made of turning points like this, you know, being that Formula 3 race in Silverstone, and my association with Jackie and Paul and the whole Stewart family, who, you know, I guess through them I met my wife, you know, you know, we're still very good friends. I'm proud to say so. Yeah, it was, you know, look, the story there was in the end of 89. I think there were two Formula 4 championships. There was the ESO and the REC, and I think I finished third in both of them. And Jackie was just launching the Staircase of Talent, you know, with Paul. And Porsche Racing was originally primarily set up for Paul, and then they expanded to two cars, and they were doing Formula 3, and then they had these plans to create the Staircase of Talent, which eventually became Stewart Grand Prix. And I guess Jackie and Paul were running a test in Donington Park at the end of 89, the season had finished and all that, and they were running a lot of different guys. I don't remember who was there, Exactly. Like I said, my memory is sometimes not very good. And went to the test. The test went really well. I broke Jackie's own lap record in Paul's Formula 4 2-liter car, and that was the beginning of it all. And Jackie, you know, there's a few people that really make an impact in your life, you know. My own family, you know, this guy that I was saying in Brazil, and I think next, for sure, as I was walking through life, you know, Jackie was hugely influential in the way I developed this, again, as a person and as a driver.
So, sorry, Simon, on you go.
Yeah, I was going to say, one of the things that's always... I think I first met you when you were in Formula 3, but just before that, you raced in Opel Lotus, Vauxhall Lotus, yeah, with Paul Stewart Racing alongside, yeah, David Coulthard.
Yeah.
And the thing that always struck me about you two was that I always found it interesting watching, because you were actually clearly mates. You're in the same team. Yeah. You've got the same ambitions.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I'd sit and chat to the pair of you in the paddock all, you know, throughout, from Vauxhall Lotus through F3 3000. Yeah. And I'd just sit and listen to you, you know, sometimes rival team, sometimes the same team, sharing information, chatting. And I thought, why can't everybody be like this? You know, I mean, the rest of motor racing is so sort of, you know, selfish. But the two of you, you formed a real bond, which is actually quite unusual, between,
yeah,
rival, you know, rivals who might one day have to kind of, you know, yeah, muscle the other one out of a seat somewhere.
Yeah, don't get me wrong, we clashed a lot of times,
yeah, yeah,
on
absolutely
the track. You know, and then I'm sure he got pissed off with me a few times, and vice versa, you know. But look, I mean, you know, David, I mean, it's really hard not to like the guy, you know.
Yeah,
He's a great person, and frankly, we struck a friendship right off the bat, you know. And I think there's a few factors to that, and you know, one is I just mentioned, and two, actually, one of the kind of lessons, I guess, or maturing that I went through this phase in 88 or something like that, it's just, you know, I don't like wasting energy with negative thoughts, you know, and feeling negative about people in the world, you know, that is just, is not productive for me. So I've over the years, I learned to be more open, more, I don't know, I guess, you know, wanting to strike always a positive a relationship with people. I find that better for me, and usually it's better for the other person. And you know, combine that with the fact that DC is a great guy, we were together all the time, because, you know, at the time to do the championship in Europe, for example, we used to drive together everywhere. We used to share rooms, and so we were spending a lot of time together, and clearly liked each other, and the friendship lasts to this day.
It's just one of the quirky things that struck me, I think, is in the paddock at Ennepagusa in 93, I think.
Yeah.
DC was at the front and you were struggling a bit.
Yeah.
And I was having some lunch with him, we were just chatting, and you appeared out of nowhere and sat down and joined us and said, can you give me a few tips? I thought, and he did. And you won the race the following year, so, yeah, you know.
Yeah, well, it's, you know, people, it's interesting, right? People, you know, in the end of the day, we are actually competing, right? We're all competitive people. We all want to do well, and so on and so forth. And people say, well, you know, there's two ways to become a winner. You know, you either push yourself forward or you push everybody else back. You know, different people and different drivers, I think, you know, they use both things to different degrees. You know, I like I said, I always found more productive to be on the, let's focus on making me better rather than focusing on making everybody else worse. And And I guess that's how we related to each other from the beginning.
Talking of David Coulthard, it sort of neatly brings me on to another bit that I wanted to talk about, the Formula One tests. And end of 92, you after winning the British Formula 3 Championship, you tested with Williams. And we've got a question here from Ben Johnson saying, you test drove an active Williams. What was it like? Did the active suspension give that delayed response on turn-in that Mansell could drive around?
I just remember the thing being stupidly fast.
I remember the brilliant
answer. Yeah, it was. It was an interesting test. Up until then, I've only driven Formula 3 cars, which at the time was just about 200 horsepower, is a little bit less. So they were not. They're very fast around the corners, but they didn't have a huge amount of power. So the next thing was to jump in Formula 3. Now I think it's much more powerful, actually. So here am I going to jump in a Formula 1 car. And so I think what we did was I said, well, look, I said to Jack and Paul, can I do a test in the 3000 car before I go drive a Formula 1? Because then I would have gone from, 180 to Formula 3000 car at the time, like 550.
450, yes.
No, they're more than that. They're about 550. And then on to 850 or 900, so a stepping stone. And interesting, the Formula 3 car, I don't know. It just it felt like an extension of my body. I felt like I could do anything with the car, so went to Silverstone to drive the 3000 car, which was, I remember sitting in the cockpit and one wheel is like over there and the other wheel is over there. Everything is big. And I'm like, wow, this is, it felt, I wasn't as at one with the car as I was with the Formula 3 car. But the day went on and I became more, became a little bit more comfortable. And, but I guess I still wasn't quite used to the width of the car. So in the last corner in Silverstone, I can't remember what that's called.
Woodcote?
No, the one before that, the little right-hander.
It was Priory, wasn't it?
Yeah.
It was something like Brooklyn's that.
But at the time, instead of being this long right-hander, it was two little right-handers with a curb on the right that came from the other side of the circuit that used to come from Bridge. Anyway, so you go through the two right-handers and you look into the right, and I remember going, and in between the two, I run a little bit too far to the left before I turned in, and climbed over the curb, which at the time curbs didn't look like they do today. And the car just went boink and went straight on and hit the wall. And I went, that was dumb. The problem was that as I hit the wall, instead of letting the steering go, because I literally just went straight and went thunk, I was holding on to the steering and hurt my wrist for the 50 millionth time. And I think the Formula One test was like 3 or 4 days later. I don't remember exactly. I know it was on my birthday. It was difficult because my wrist was hurting. The car was tiny. So you're sitting there like, ugh.
They cut the monocoque, I think, didn't they? They actually cut some extra space for you.
Well, no. The what happened was I did a seat fit in... in Williams, at Williams, right? Or in or at?
At Williams. With Williams.
Yeah, with Williams, yeah. So went over there, and and they used the carbon shells, and they weren't going to make a new carbon shell for me. So I was either going to use Ricardo seat, Damon seat, or Nigel seat. And, you know, the pedals, you know, is want to be one of the three, because Formula One cars, they don't have a adjustable anything, right? They make new bits to perfectly fit that one driver to save weight mostly and gain stiffness and so on. Same thing with the steering wheel. And I tried to make a combination of the three work. But to be honest, I was very, you know, I felt like in a sardine can, you know, really struggling to fit properly in the car. But I guess in my enthusiasm, I thought, nah, like, it'll be okay. And particularly on the steering, it was hard because those were the days where the steering was underneath the cockpit. So I had my hands hitting the top and hitting my leg. But I'm like, no, I can do this, you know. And so we went out, you know, to do an installation lap, went into cops, and ding, and there was a bumping cops, and it was wet, okay? I'm like, yeah, no problem. The car just slid a little bit. And I'm like, yeah, no worries, you know, little correction. And I locked my elbows, locked like this. I mean, and the car just went this very silly slow spin, and the engine stalled. I'm like, idiot, you know. and my mind was racing at the time, and I'm like, what am I gonna do? What am I gonna do? What am I gonna do? And the guys came in, you know, it was just us and on the track, and Alain Prost, actually, who hadn't started running yet. And restarted the engine. I came back into the pits, and I said, look, I'm sorry, I'm going to have to cancel the test. And they looked at me and went, what? I said, oh, look, I don't want to crash your car, you know. I will, because I can't. You know, I can't even move the steering wheel properly. So, you know, rather than you judge me on crashing the car, I'd rather not do anything, you know. Which was kind of a tough position for a whatever 20-something rookie to take. And so, you know, a couple phone calls later, I'm sitting there thinking, what's going to happen? I can't remember the guy who was running the test team as a good guy. And he came in and said, look, tell you what we're going to do. We can cut the seat and make it, you know, to try to fit you the best you can. So they went, cut this beautiful seat that was perfectly made for the car. And so, you know, a couple of tries, a little bit more here, a little bit less. So my elbow would fit inside this hole between the seat and the cockpit. And so we moved the steering about a little bit. Anyway, got to a point that it was reasonable. And they go, you happy? I said, yeah, I think I am. Yeah, you got 15 laps. So I'm like, okay. and that was it. You know, I did like three runs or five laps, and eventually I was on a reasonable pace. To be honest, the car felt amazing. You know, it had so much grip, even in the wet. Man, the active suspension was awesome. I remember going, yeah, I have a little bit of understeer here. So they go, move this button, you know, one click to the right. Oh, it's finished. You know, it was a great experience for me.
Now, you obviously had another Formula One test with footwork, yeah. which didn't end quite so well.
No, I didn't.
It's probably another lesser known record, actually.
Yeah, it's, you know, it was a kind of a similar story, but it ended up a little bit different, shall we say, because the Williams sets really ended up on a positive note. You know, my pace relative to Prost, who I'm sure wasn't trying at all. But anyway, it was comparable. So went to Estoril. And now this is more serious, proper test, you know, is being considered for the drive. Again, an active suspension car. But again, I had whatever. I don't know what my shape is like because, you know, I'm not certainly the tallest guy around, but I really struggled to fit in the car. The steering was like, felt like it was in my nose. My legs, my knees were up against the, I don't like Berger. I met him a few years ago. I got to know him a little bit better. I asked, how did you fit in those cars? And he's like, with great difficulty. Anyway, I was, again, very uncomfortable in the car. But, you know, I guess good enough to go and drive. And I can't remember, a few runs, about 20 laps. I was really struggling with, how do you call it when you have like a muscle, your muscle?
Cramp.
Cramps. Cramps on my back, cramps on my butt, you know, because my legs were being thrown to the side, and cramps on my wrist, believe it or not. And I'm like, look, I need to get out, and I need to go to the toilet, you know. So I got out of the car, and I was walking between the two trucks, you know, thinking about how am I gonna improve, how am I gonna tackle this, and so on. And smash my head against a belly locker, and because I was looking at the ground, that was the end of the test. You know, it was an interesting experience. You know, unlike the Williams, I didn't really like that car at all. I was reasonably competitive on the slow bits, on the high speed corners. It was just all pain, you know. You sit there, my back. it was all pain, and the Formula One car is I don't know what they are like now, but they were, you know, what struck me is that they were very violent. You know, I mean, you hit the brakes, bah, you know, turn the wheel, bah, you know, very. And the ride was always very harsh. You know, it's a very violent car. I thought the 3000 car was a very kind of violent car, and that was a step further.
Now, before we move on to kart, I've got another reader's question here from Entropy, saying, "Hi, Jill, did you have an offer for Stewart Grand Prix?"
Well, you know, as I already said, well, I always had a great relationship with Jackie and Paul. We did have some conversations about it, but you know, at the time, it's just, you know, I said that I think a few times in the past. I think whether the timing or whether I didn't feel the opportunity was the right opportunity, that ended up never happening, you know, and it was, you know, the conversations never went much further with Jackie and Paul, because I think primarily timing, you know. I was, you know, doing my deals in America very early. It's just, you know, we never took it much further.
Do you have any? I know you say you don't like to waste negative, you know, waste energy with negative thoughts, but a lot of the guys you raced, I mean, you won the British Formula 3 Championship, yeah. You won lots of Formula Ford races, you won you're a title contender in Formula 3000. A lot of the guys you raced against went on to become Grand Prix winners.
Yeah.
Do you have any regrets that your contribution to Formula 1 was banging your head on a footwork belly locker?
Nah, in a way, no, Simon. You know, in a different universe, you know, God knows what might have happened. But you know, as I look back at my life and my career, and what has happened, you know, and when I decided to retire in 03, I'm thinking to myself, well, you know, I ended up winning a lot of races, championships, and you know, the 500. I think one of the things I'm most proud of is actually driving for Roger. You know, I always placed a lot of value, not only in the success on the track, but the people you're associated with, and you know, driving for a guy like Roger, it's almost like driving for Ferrari. You know, his organization, and in to me, not just in Formula One, but in the world of motorsports, I think holds a special place. So I'm like, you know, I'm happy. I feel like I achieved, you know, I achieved a lot. And so I don't think that way. The one thing that I would have liked to have done is race against Michael. I always watched him carefully. I never shared the track with him. And I really wanted to race against him. I'm sure that would have been very difficult. you know, I think I enjoyed the challenges like that, and I had a lot of respect and admiration for his craft and how he performed. I thought, I wish I could have raced against that guy.
But not in the footwork, because that would have hurt your back.
Yeah, exactly.
Just before we sort of get onto to Fontana and the championships and things, now your first taste of an IndyCar was through Jim Hall, of kart, sorry. And that was because Teo Fabi couldn't run. But you went to go and test the car, but you hadn't you just damaged your neck in a testing accident at Monza in Formula 3000? There seems to be a recurring theme here, doesn't there? Sort of 101 ways to ruin a career.
Yeah, exactly. We were testing in Monza, the 3000, fighting for the championship before going to ENA. Yeah. Okay. Because it was the low downforce track, whatever. And, you know, without any false modesty, I was like a second and a half quicker than everyone, thinking, yeah, watch this. You know, you guys have no chance.
So Simon and I have absolutely no idea what that feels like.
Yeah, exactly.
Zero.
Obviously my ambitions got a little bit too big for my boots, breaking into the Ascari chicane. Because I was going deeper and deeper and deeper and exploring different things, and lost it on the braking, turning left to the Ascari chicane, spun and hit. And at the time, the wall on the left had no tires, no nothing, and literally hit dry concrete head on, like bang. and my head hit the steering wheel, you know, and I remember having this immediate headache, and I'm thinking, great, you know. So hospital job for already third or fourth time, you know, lie down, you know, go to the hospital, and I had a concussion and mild concussion, and stretch my whatever the ligaments of my neck or something. Remember going back home, sitting on the sofa thinking, idiot, you know, with a neck brace, and like you couldn't quite move. And when the phone phone rings, and this different accent, I'm like, hello, it's Joe the Farron there. And I'm like, yeah, did you like my American accent? No. And
you spent long enough there.
Yeah, exactly. And anyway, so it turns out to be Jim, and to your point, he says, look, Teo can't make the test. He would like for you to test a car. I said, yeah, I would love to, you know, but I need to ask Jackie and Paul and ask permission. So yeah, no problem. When is the test? This like, you know, this is like a Wednesday. It's like it's Friday, you know. And I'm like, oh, I see. Obviously, no mention of the neck issue. So I called Jackie, and who actually linked me up with a doctor as well. You know, took some painkillers, and the doctor said, look, you're not going to damage your neck, but it's going to hurt like hell. So went on to do the I think the next day I was in the plane to go to Midland, Texas.
I've got a question here from Scott Alderson, who's asking what it was like to drive for Jim Hill, because you obviously then went on to drive for him.
Yeah, well, it's another reoccurring theme in my life. You know, I was very lucky to come across these incredible people, you know, that really made a mark on me as I walked through my life. And Jim was certainly one of them. You know, he's... a very knowledgeable person, knows a lot about racing, knows a lot about cars, knows a lot about, like Jackie, about, you know, attitude and how to manage yourself and how to decide things. And I really learned a lot from Jim that way. He really understood well the intersection between driving and engineering, which is, frankly, that's kind of where I lived as a driver, without any false modesty. I think that was one thing that I was competent at, really connecting the two worlds. And Jim was very much an expert in this, and relating what happens to the car in engineering terms.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Now, before we talk about Fontana and the record, we've had loads of questions about that. I just wanted to talk a little bit about sort of what happened before you were spotted by Penske, because you had this period after Jim Hall's sponsorship faded away. You went to Derek Walker, and you had, I think, was it 5 crashes in 3 weekends or something?
Yeah, something
and
like that.
Yeah, and you said, "I'm sorry, I didn't mean to." Say that. We will focus on the highs in a second. But
highlighting.
Yeah,
stuff,
we'll talk about highlights in a second. But I think you said that you went away and just had to kind of recalibrate your brain after that, because you weren't going about it the right way. But it's amazing to hear that you can kind of step back and actually have that.
Yeah, look, won a race in 95 on my first year, won a race in 96. In 96, I think I finished 6th in the championship, you know. Jim was winding the team down, and we were competing at some pretty big operations. And so, you know, the expectation was, okay, here I am, I'm going to fight for the championship, you know. So I signed with Derek, who had a bigger operation, a very good sponsorship. The team was very well funded, with good support from Honda, you know, good support from Goodyear. So it was all right, that's it. Championship challenge. you know, and I was always call it an attacking sort of guy, you know. I was most comfortable in the lead, you know. Some guys love the driving through the field, and I was an expert in disappearing into the distance. And that, you know, I guess that takes a certain mindset, right? So you like, you know, practice, you know, you're just always attacking. And you know, so again, I suppose I was trying to do more than what was there, and making mistakes. You know, to be fair, I think out of these five crashes and three cars that were destroyed in the meantime, they weren't all my fault, but they were.
Are you sure?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure. But they were a sequence of, you know, things just kind of, I guess, you know, I'm not a particularly mystical person, but it's almost like the universe is trying to talk to you and say, dude, you need to shift gears here and then look at a different path, because this one is not going to be good for you. And you have to pay attention to those things. And I remember it was Long Beach. I put the car on pole position on Friday, because those who did it here, Friday and Saturday, and we were so much faster than everybody else on Friday that Saturday morning, actually that crash is on YouTube if you guys want to look at it. On Saturday practice, I went to pass someone on the main street in Long Beach, and there was a car that had an engine problem, stopped on the right, and I couldn't see the car because I was behind another car. So when I went to the right to pass him, I hit this guy at 170 miles an hour or something like that, and destroyed that car. But I think the day before I was on pole by whatever, a second or something silly like that, and the time held from Friday. I wasn't beaten on Saturday because I didn't participate in qualifying. So started the race, and I'm thinking, right, this is me off into the distance here, and we had some problems with the tires. We started the tires started to grain. So now the Formula One guys that are watching, so we had graining tires even back then. The tires started to grain, and I started to struggle, and had to do sometimes early stops, had to use more fuel to maintain the pace. And I kept, you know, every pit stop, I just kept going backwards. And I'm getting more and more frustrated and driving, you know, with less and less margin, and eventually I made a mistake, and dunk into the tires in turn one, and this I think was the fifth crash, you know, and I was just like a knife went through me, and I said, look, I remember I pulled the team together after that. And I said, look, that's it. There will be no more crashes, you know. I don't know. It was I shifted my attitude. And we finished second in the championship behind Zanardi, I think it was. But it was again, it's, I guess my life is never been kind of smooth, you know. You sort of go. Something happens. You mature, you learn something that is remarkable, that has this ability to transform you a little bit.
How did the contact with Penske come about? Because you deal with Penske, was announced, I think, in the summer of 99.
Yeah.
Are you going to be joining them the following
season?
Well,
I guess, you know, Walker and Penske were the two teams on Goodyear. At the time, Firestone had a competitive advantage, and which kind of started in 96, and just sort of that competitive advantage just kept growing. So we're finding more and more difficult to be fighting for championships and wins. I managed to win a race, I think it was 98 or 99, I don't remember exactly, but it was kind of a dry period, frankly, you know. I was doing a lot of tire testing, and which was actually good for me. So even though the results, I'm sure, weren't even as good as Goodyear would have liked, or what we would have liked, but it was a period that I learned a lot. I was doing I think 1 year I did 75 test days. It was an enormous amount of driving, and
how many accidents?
Not very many, actually. Yeah, and so you know, at the end, and so throughout this period, it was basically Penske Racing and Walker Racing with the same tires, and I guess I was, you know, we were quite a bit more competitive than them through that period. You know, I think Roger, you know, you don't call Roger. Roger calls you, basically. You know, it's interesting. This young guy says, "Oh, how do I get in touch with Roger?"
Wait.
If he's interested in you, he'll call you. Don't you worry about it. You know. So in early '99, Roger's trying to get in touch with you, and we spoke and did a deal incredibly fast, actually.
It must have been a very nice feeling, though. Roger Penske's.
Yeah, it was. It was. And I was hugely impressed by him. It's hard to explain, man. It's just such a committed person, you know, and clear and determined and, you know, is an incredible businessman, an incredible person, and you talk again of the people you meet through your life, and he was another guy that was like, wow, you know, I've learned a lot from him. It was a great feeling to, you know, at the time wear the Marlboro suit that I guess for Brazilians, given Emerson and Ayrton's, you know, past, you know, you look at yourself in the mirror, you go, you know, it was, to your point, a nice moment in my life.
There were obviously many high points with Penske.
Yeah.
And one of them is the 241.426 mile an hour lap,
yeah,
at Fontana, which, along with bumping your head in the transporter, is a record that still stands to this day.
Yeah.
We've had quite a few questions about this, but both Miles and Matthew kind of wanted you to sort of talk them through the lap. Miles added that, was it Matthew that added, Dario said you buzzed the rev limiter coming out of the pits, question mark.
Dario's lying. this is the championship decider. We were fighting, I guess, five other guys. I don't remember exactly. And at the time, the pole position gave an extra point, and also at the time you could change engines as many times as you like throughout the weekend, and Honda was really behind the engine program. They made an incredible engine for Fontana. It was a qualifying special, so it was a new engine Friday night, you know, put the engine on the car, go out, you know, I did two runs, I think, Saturday morning. I wanted to run more. They're like, no. No, you're done. And the car was really good. It was, you know, I remember coming out of the pits, So they finally put the qualifying map just for qualifying. That gave that even a little bit more power. Going out of the pits, and you could do like 4 warm-up laps. So there was no hurry to really get up to speed too fast. So it was a real balance between getting the tire pressures to where you wanted, together with the rubber at the temperature you wanted, without taking the edge off. It was a bit of an art, actually, to do that properly, because we didn't have all the information that the guys had. So you kind of had to do it by feel and experience and so on. Anyway, the bottom line is I used the typical thing was to start the lap quite slowly, you know, so you didn't burn up your tires. So I come out of the pits, you know, trying actually not to light them up.
Or buzzing the rev limiter.
Or buzzing the rev limiter, exactly. But I remember going, very, you know, slowly, like you drive a road car, coming out of the pits, in the back straight. I think it was about 4th gear, and the tires are stone cold. And I'm thinking, yeah, maybe I'll go flat now. And the thing just lit up like in 4th. I'm like, whoop. 5th gear. Anyway, so we were just winding up to speed, and you know, you go in there with the mindset, it's like, I ain't lifting. and oval racing, particularly qualifying, when you have that little bit of extra grip from the tires, it's really a bit of a leap of faith. Because if you use the tires too soon to find out if you do have the grip or not, then you're going to lose a little bit of performance. So you're really sort of building up this picture of how much grip you have, what the balance is like, without complete information. And so it's a little bit of a leap of faith. And if you lift before to find out, you're too slow. So you really have to go, right, it's a commitment thing. I'm doing it. And then if you get in trouble, you got to figure out a way to recover. So when they're in their mindset, when, you know, I remember, because I had like on my dash, I knew my exit speeds. I remember opening the lap at 2:39 and coming out at turn 4. I'm thinking, wow. And that was like 2 miles an hour quicker than I'd seen the whole weekend. Going into turn 1 in Fontana, super bumpy, actually. And, you know, the car was super neutral when you're going, and the thing is going like this. You know, really small. It's funny because I've seen it on YouTube as well, and it, you know, it looks like it's just stuck, but you know, in the car you just you know, release pressure, a little bit more pressure, and the car is, you know, moving around a little bit, but and it's very neutral. You know, hardly, you know, not. I wasn't oversteery, I wasn't understeery, I was like just on the edge. And the car was so you know, we were using the tires so much that I closed the lap slower than what I opened it, you know. So I closed the lap, I exited at 2:38. So about a mile an hour slower coming out of turn 4 than I was to start the lap. And there was that, you know. I mean, the great engine, great chassis, good setup. You know, it was a good day.
Now, we are sort of running slightly short on time with quite a lot to cover. Obviously, the Indy 500 win, which unsurprisingly was with carrying an injury.
Yeah.
there is a theme here. There is a theme.
I never actually thought about that in that way, I have to be honest with you.
We've had quite a few questions about Honda, because obviously you went there to BAR Honda, the Formula One team. Yeah. There's one here that is quite nice, and it's from David, who said you once said when you arrived at Honda, you were amazed how good Jenson Button actually was.
Yeah.
And he said, I believe you mentioned his telemetry traces, and we've heard about how he drives with no overlap and how silky smooth his inputs are. Could you please elaborate and about his talent?
What impressed me about Jenson was just great feel, you know, really, really good feel for grip. You know, he could get to the edge very quickly, you know, and readjust himself very, very quickly, and very precisely. So I was very impressed about that. I remember a few situations. I think it was qualifying in Silverstone in 06 or something, when I think he did the first run, and he was okay, you know, it was an okay run. And the second run, he just adjusts his inputs to almost to perfection. You know, I think that he got the balance a little bit better to how he wanted. And I'm like, wow. You know, he never overdid it. He never underdid it. He wasn't conservative. He was just, you know, the mix was just right. And he can only do that if you have tremendous feel. I think for the amount of grip, for how the car is handling, and so on. So I was very impressed by that, Jenson. A very good driver.
So you had a management role in Formula One with Honda. You had your own sports car team in America, which was successful.
Yeah.
You've now got a management role with McLaren.
Yeah.
So you've done both sides. Which do you feel carries more pressure, the driving bit or the management bit?
I can't answer your question because
probably
I don't
get injured less.
Yeah, well, yeah, probably. I don't think of the world in terms of pressure. That's why I have difficulty answering your question, Simon. I wanted this life. You know, I put myself in this situation. So it goes back to the negativity conversation that we were talking about. Yeah, there's a lot at stake. Yeah, if I fail in whichever role, then that can be painful for me and for others, by the way, you know. So you can say that's you know, a pressure, you know, that a failure could, you know, affect your future prospects. But then again, it always does. But then again, what's your option? Your option is not to put yourself in that situation by not taking chances, by not experimenting the world, by not putting yourself out there, you know, because, and then, yeah, you won't feel that pressure. You won't experience the possibility of failure, which is ever present. It's the possibility of failure is always there. If you choose for it to be there, I can sit at home and not feel that. So I always, you know, whether in a management role, whether as a driver, I kind of developed this view, you know, that I'm like, well, I'm here because I want to be. I want to be in the fire. It makes me feel alive. Yes, I can fail. Yes, it can all go seriously wrong, you know. And yes, this can seriously affect my present and my future. But that's what I want. You know, I want to be in that position.
Do you get... We're talking just a few days after the French Grand Prix, in which McLaren had a good weekend.
Yeah.
Both cars qualified in the top six. Carlos Sainz finished sixth. And given recent results, that's a clear step in the right direction. Do you get the same buzz out of success or relative success in your management role as you had as a driver? Or is it a completely different experience?
It's a completely different experience, you know. I don't know about you, but as I'm getting older...
I've never been successful, so I would never clue.
No, you have been successful. Don't say that. As I'm getting older, I find myself experiencing different feelings, you know? like, you know, I have a great feeling of seeing somebody else succeed. Being with my own kids, you know, being with some of my loved relatives, or even with my team, you know. So when you see other people, you know, which you had a hand in organizing, in mentoring, in educating, so on and so forth, achieve success. As I'm getting older, I experience a lot of joy from that. Is it the same as the joy of driving a racing car? Is it the same as the joy of winning a competition? No, it's a completely different feeling. But it's but then again, I sit here today and I think I don't think I have the same fire that I had when I was driving, you know, full time. That burning desire is not there. So I don't know. I'm seeing myself sort of transforming through life. That desire to sit in a car and really take it to the absolute limit, come what may. So I don't have that desire anymore. So because I don't have that desire, I don't experience the feeling of loss. You know, oh, I wish it was me driving that car. You know, I get my kicks in a different way now.
Now, but before we finish, it'd be great to talk about Alonso Indy, and you mentored him when he first went there. There's a two-parted question. Anthony Jenkins wants to talk obviously about Alonso, but he asked whether Alonso is currently the best driver on the planet. There was the huge success of his first time at Indy, comparatively, and then I'd like to add a second part to the question of what happened this year. Where did it all go wrong?
Yeah, well, a lot went wrong. I'll start with the negative first. Look, in the end of the day, it's our fault. You know, we didn't prepare ourselves well enough. We didn't execute well enough, and at Indianapolis, you pay the price. You know, we certainly learned a lot of lessons, and some incredibly painful lessons. You know, we exposed ourselves to failure by wanting to be there, by putting ourselves in that position. You know, and trying to meet a very difficult challenge, and we failed. You know, and it was painful. We move on. we absorb those lessons, and we try not to repeat them. And if we ever go back, which I hope we will, we'll try to tackle that challenge with those lessons in mind. And you know, now to the positive. You know, the second part of the first part of your question regarding Fernando. Look, I mean, the guy I think he's one of the best drivers that's ever lived, frankly. I mean, it's hard to know because, you know, I wasn't around when people like Jim Clark and Fangio were racing, or even Jackie, who... Actually, have you been in the car with Jackie or not?
No, I haven't.
Oh, my God. It's an experience that is like in a different planet. But anyway, back to Fernando. I mean, the guy is just, you know, again, incredible feel. Just it's that combination of intelligence, talent, determination, knowledge, experience, everything into one. I always say Sometimes these young guys go, "Oh, but I'm really fast." I say, "Congratulations, you reach level number, you have one ingredient out of 100 that you need to be a successful racing driver." I miss a big one: emotional control. And a guy like Fernando, I mean, he scores, a 9.5 or 10 out of 10 on all of these 100 ingredients. How do you deal with the team? How do you set up a car? How do you control your own emotions under different circumstances? I mean, the guy is incredible. I mean, I've seen him do things in a racing car. There's sometimes that, if you're watching on TV and stuff, you can't appreciate it, but you see things that you go, and I'm a little bit arrogant, right? I thought I was good. And I go, yeah, okay, that was pretty impressive.
Are there any examples of
I think one that I don't mind mentioning that comes to mind was Monaco last year in qualifying. We were having a difficult weekend. We had a mechanical failure in FP1, then had another problem in FP2. Don't ask me for specifics because I really have a hard time remembering a lot of these things correctly. But anyway, it had been a very difficult weekend. And FP3 was struggling with the balance of the car. We go to qualifying. And we literally changed the whole car, right? Floor, front wing, springs, you name it. It was a wholesale change based on it. So it wasn't like a roll of the dice, but based on the data that the guys were looking at and experience, they concluded, okay, we need to go put the car in here. Like normal, your first lap is your best lap. So you're going into qualifying now with, less fuel, more engine, completely different car. Track has changed from FP3 to quali. And he goes out and it's a street circuit. So in a street circuit, you can't just run wide, right? So I overdid it. I run wide. And in the street circuit, if you run wide, you're in the fence. And Monaco has some pretty fast corners that you really have to commit. And and by the way, same problem with the tires, right? So you can't really use up the tires before you start the lap because you got to be careful with temperature and so on and so forth. Anyway, he goes to qualify, and I usually watch it by looking at the telemetry overlay, so I know what the fastest lap he did before, and he nails every corner, like miles faster than he had been throughout the weekend, including like very, committed corners like Tabac, which is like I think one downshift and straight back on the throttle, and I'm sitting there going, I guess you didn't need to get used to that, did you? and that lap was good enough, I think, to put him. It would have been, I don't remember exactly, but it would have been good enough to, for him to go forward. I think he eventually went to Q3. In that particular race. So, but the rest of qualifying was impressive, but not as impressive that first lap, because given the circumstances that we arrived at.
Well, Joe, one thing he hasn't done is win the Indy 500.
No.
But it has been an absolutely wonderful hour and a bit. I'm sorry we've kept you for longer than we probably should have.
No, it's been a pleasure.
Yeah. Can I just have one last question?
Absolutely, yeah. Simon. Yeah.
Did you ever finish your university degree?
I never did finish my university degree.
Well, that makes two of us. That's good.
I never did. And actually, to be honest, I loved engineering. I was one of those guys that always I wanted to be an engineer. So these days, and I after university, I'm a reader, I like studying things and so on. So I tried to educate myself as much as I could, but I'm not a full-blown graduate engineer, and there's still time though. There's still time.
Brilliant. Jill, thank you so much for joining us. Simon, thank you to Alan as well for recording it all. We will see you all next month when we do a podcast with Sir Chris Hoy. We'll see you then. Thank you very much for listening and for watching. Bye-bye.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.